The police attack on a black girl viewed by millions around the world draws protests, resignations, and renews the debate about policing in the U.S., we'll spend the hour focused on women and girls here in the DMV, the nation, and around the world. Coming up next. Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for June 11, 2015 on WPFW Washington, 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Varum, here with Michael Nasella on the boards and Michael Byfield, who will help to take your calls in the second half of the show. Shout out to Eitan and Davey Z. It's Varum, Dave Varum. Anyway, today we have another jam-packed show, this one focused on women and girls here in the DMV, around the U.S. and around the world. We'll hear words from the vocalist Kaba speaking this past Saturday at a community benefit held for his children after the tragic death of his wife, Michelle Io Jones-Bell, who joined the Ancestors after a bout with cancer. We'll hear shocking statistics about what is killing adolescent girls around the world, and in the second half, take your calls about the abuse of a defenseless girl, Dejeria Becton, by police in McKinney, Texas, captured on video and viewed millions of times around the world. As always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, starting with this week's headlines and happenings. Well, as the country reels from the latest video depicting police brutality, the Washington Ethical Society is staging the second in a series of weekly roadside remembrances tonight during rush hour from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. at 7750 16th Street Northwest in D.C. The public is invited to join this action, which builds on the sidewalk solidarity action by members of the faith community along 16th Street last fall. Participants will hold signs with the names of people killed by police, Black Lives Matter signs, and other messages. These actions, every Thursday at 5:30 p.m., will have a person of the week that will be studied and remembered. Today's protest will remember Walter Scott, killed April 4th, 2015, in South Carolina by Michael Slager, who was just charged with murder by a grand jury. For more information about the Thursday actions, go to ethicalsociety.org. In other news from the Black Lives Matter movement, D.C. Ferguson is planning a rally for next Wednesday, June 16th at 7 p.m. at Mount Vernon Square Park at 7th and K Streets in Northwest D.C. to mark the anniversary of the June 16th, 1976 Soweto Uprising of South African students, which helped to spark the anti-apartheid movement. And Color of Change, colorofchange.org, is circulating a petition calling for charges against Eric Casebolt, that McKinney, Texas police officer caught on video brutalizing and endangering black teenagers attending a pool party. Young people have also started a GoFundMe campaign to stage a new pool party for the youths attacked by Casebolt, who has resigned and issued an apology through his attorney. Baltimore-based police reform activist DeRay McKesson told MSNBC last night that Casebolt's statement yesterday, given through his attorney, that he was emotionally overwrought when he arrived at the pool party after responding to two suicide calls, is no excuse for his brutality against a young girl and pulling a gun on another teen.
If anything, it confirms this idea that he actually should not have been an officer at all. That if he had emotional trauma that he needed to work through, that he should never have been in a position where he could have taken someone's life, which is the position he was in when he drew his gun. So if anything, I'm recommitted to this notion that we need to figure out the standards for what policing is and how to deal with their emotional trauma. That officer bypassed many white young people who were there and put his hands on many black young people. And as the person who took the video said, is that he said, I felt invisible, which allowed him to continue filming, and the officer did nothing to him, but the officer put his knees in the back of a young black girl in a bikini who posed no threat, and he took his gun out to young men of color because he knew that he could and he knew that he had the power to do. It's definitely racially coded. We can't continue to believe that racism only exists at the extreme, was with the N-word and lynching. That was an act of racism there too. He escalated the situation because he had the power to do it, and he wanted to control control not only the situation but also their bodies that pose no threat to him.
And in race and labor news, a new report, And Still I Rise, Black Women Labor Leaders' Voices, Power, and Promise, was the focus of a special briefing on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. Highlights of the report from the Institute for Policy Studies include the successful efforts of black women to organize into unions. In 2014, black women were only second to black men in having the highest union representation rate compared with other race or gender groups. For black women who are low-wage earners, union membership was a greater factor than education in determining increased wages and benefits. On average, black women union members earn more than $2 more per hour and are 20% more likely to have health care. The report also highlighted the success of black women and other women of color as union organizers. Women of color have the highest election win rates among all demographic groups. More information is available about the report online at andstillirise.org. And in our culture and media moment, On the Ground was on hand at the Brentwood Arts Exchange for the opening reception for the exhibit At War with Ourselves, The Battle of and for the Black-Faced Boy, a response to a poem by Nikki Finney. The show, featuring members of Black Artists of D.C., responds to a poem by Finney that traces the African male from Africa to the shores of the United States to today.
My name is Akili Ron Anderson, and I'm a member of the board of Black Arts DC. I'm a participant in the show here at the Brentwood, and we are what we consider contemporary black, meaning that we're in touch with the black movement, the new black arts movement. That's a news flash. Yes, this is the Black Arts Movement 2. So look forward to hearing about that and how university where I teach with Black Arts DC, with anything that's contemporary black, meaning that we're in touch with the new black struggle. Visually, our lifestyles, and our commitment to the next generation.
So tell me about your piece in the show.
My piece in the show is called Space Face. And that deals with spirituality, but also understanding the totality of the cosmos. And when you understand that and have that perspective, and you look down on the world, you're able to make more intelligent decisions about how we operate on the Earth as, terrestrials, let's say.
My name is Aliana Grace Bailey. I'm from D.C., and I think this is an amazing show. It's very empowering. It's always great to see black artists come together, especially to have this type of dialogue. It's been really inspiring. My work is called, it's a series, it's called the Threat Series. One is Our Skin is a Threat, Our Beauty is a Threat, and Our Strength is a Threat. And it was actually inspired by the shooting of Mike Brown and the different emotions that I was going through during that time period. And it's kind of a play on words. I wanted to be both positive and shed light on the negativity at the same time. And so it was really about highlighting these amazing things about black people. But to America, they're looked at as threats. And so it was really about just highlighting that and really letting out that emotion that I was going through at the time period. The first one says, our skin is a threat. The second says, our beauty is a threat. And the third says, our strength is a threat. And I actually completed them in that order as well. So I first came up with the statement, our skin is a threat, during that time period where I was going through a lot of different emotions. I write my thoughts down a lot. And then from there, I was like, I can't just create a piece that says our skin is a threat. Like, that's incomplete. So I thought that I had to create a series off of it. So that's where beauty and strength came from.
My name is Chanel Compton, and I am a visual artist, and I created the 5-foot collage portrait of a young Huey P. Newton. And in this series of collages I created, I focused on black males, particularly black males who were either enslaved and resisted or were civil rights activists, but as a whole who resisted against racial oppression. And a lot of the men that I rendered were civil rights activists, but they were victims of violence, like Martin Luther King, Huey P. Newton. I did one of Nat Turner and of Charles Ball, which not too many people know about, but he was enslaved in Calvert County. He escaped and he enlisted in the War of 1812, but because of the fugitive slave law, he was made to go back. So basically, I wanted to do like younger versions of these men because, and I think that's kind of like a really interesting parallel because so many young black men are continue to be racial criminalized and not, I mean, and like it says in the poem, not given the fair and equitable space to be themselves, to make mistakes, and just to live, you know?
What do you think about the show?
I really like it. I think it's great. Group shows are always great because, you know, you're bringing artists together and to meet and to create strong networks, and especially within the Black DC art scene, within the DMV area. I mean, it's so minimal. And BADC, I mean, it's such an amazing collective, and it's so crucial to keeping the Black art scene alive in the DMV because there is no consistent Black art space in DC, and that is crazy. That's insane. Like, Black culture built D.C. Black culture built the United States. Black culture built the Americas, but we have to kind of fight for our space. And I think that shows like these are paramount to keeping Black arts and Black arts alive.
At War with Ourselves, The Battle of and for the Blackface Boy, a visual response to a poem by Nikki Finney continues through July 18th at the Brentwood Arts Exchange in Brentwood, Maryland. This Saturday, June 13th, marks the opening of the Nakba Museum, Project of Memory and Hope, at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road in Northwest D.C. Nakba, translated into catastrophe in Arabic, refers to the mass expulsion of Palestinians from their homes in 1948 and represents a dark period in the Palestinian existence. However, the Nakba is not just a singular event in the past. It is an ongoing reality for all Palestinians who live under the Israeli occupation, according to the organizers of the Nakba Museum, Project of Memory and Hope. The stories of the Nakba have often been ignored and in many cases deliberately erased or violently suppressed. Israel's Nakba law, passed in 2011, has further silenced these deeply personal human stories by making it illegal for public organizations to raise awareness about the Nakba. The museum will be launched in stages and initially display paintings, artwork, educational materials, articles, historic artifacts, and show movies. In stage two, it will host events, seminars, conferences, in which refugees and their relatives share their personal stories. More information about the museum project and Saturday's launch is at nakbamuseumproject.org. And finally, on Saturday night, hundreds of people gathered at a special fundraiser to benefit the children of Michelle Ayo Jones Bell, who joined the ancestors at the young age of 45 on March 20th of this year after a bout with cancer. Jones Bell was a mother of three and wife of the vocalist Todd Bell, also known as Kaba Akintunde. Near the end of the program, Kaba took the stage with the Rhythm Method Band and addressed the crowd.
People look at me and they say how composed I've been, but trust and believe, you know, each and every day is a struggle. And I have my moments throughout the week, but that's because I'm a human being. And a couple of weeks ago, I came to the revelation that, you know, sometimes when I felt myself being a little emotional around my children, I would kind of go to another space and so they wouldn't see it. And then I realized, well, they need to see it. They need to understand that it's okay to grieve. And so I just held them. And sometimes you look at them and you think, you know, these children deserve to have a mother. And especially a mother as wonderful as their mother was. And if you know her, and I see her coworker Laverne over there, if you know her and also one of her, I guess she called you her daughter of sorts, Liana, yes, at work. People who know her know that she was just a very giving person, not a hater, an anti-hater. She was a lover. She anybody who needed help, she would definitely look out for people. And so definitely with her children. And sometimes I get a little down when I think about that, but then at the same time I look at them and I see her And I say without her, they couldn't be. So I'm grateful for that, because that's really at the end of the day, you know, we live in a world that tries to tell us that we need all these external things. But at the end of the day, the only thing you really have in this world is your family and your children and your parents and your loved ones. That's all you got. That's, I knew that before intellectually, but going through this process now, it has become abundantly clear that that is really the only thing you have. And so I will say this, that if you have some kind of issue with a parent, with a loved one, if you really look at it in the grand scheme of things, it's probably not all that deep. And even if the person is the one who did you wrong, you need to go step to that person and make things right. Because life is short. My wife and I had a beautiful relationship. We didn't have that issue. So I have a clean slate. I have a light heart. I know that I lived my life to the fullest with that woman. I know I gave that woman everything I had. I know she gave me everything she had. And so I don't have any regrets. And that's a lot of times what people are pained with when somebody passes, is that they have regrets. I don't have any regrets at all. And that's one of the things that helps me to get through. And so I beseech you to leave, to use a word that you only hear in the Bible. And on Sunday tomorrow, I beseech of thee.
Brethren.
That if there's somebody out there that is a loved one, make it right. You know, make it right. Don't leave any regrets. And I know that you feel me. Somebody out there. I know a lot of you feel me.
Yes.
So just do that. Okay? Can we make a deal? Can we do that?
Yes.
All right. I didn't mean to say all that, but that's the thing that just came to me. All right? So thank you very much.
A fund and website has been established to benefit the children of Michelle I.O. Jones Bell. You can get more information at thebellchildrenmemorialfund.com. That's thebellchildrenmemorialfund.com. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, a researcher uncovers the hard truth about what is killing young girls around the world. Stay with us.
This is a song right here that for a long time has been one of my favorites. And it's a song that makes you feel good and puts things in perspective on one of those days when you're feeling kind of low. Because it makes you think about the most important things in life, like your family, like I talked about before, like my babies. So I look at them and I'm all right. This is called Lovely Day. More important to me now than ever. Here we go. When I wake up in the morning, love, the sunlight hurts my eyes. Something without warning, love, weighs heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and you can be sure, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
Lovely, 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 lovely.
That was the Rhythm Method Band, including Kaba, performing Saturday night at the benefit for the Bell Children at the Everlasting Life Restaurant in Capitol Heights, Maryland. Special thanks to Top to Bottom Productions for production assistance on that segment. This is Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, onthegroundshow.org, dedicated to social justice activists and activism. I'm Esther Averam. Well, next we're going to turn to the well-being of adolescent girls when my next guest, Suzanne Petroni of the International Center for Research on Women, analyzed a report from the World Health Organization about adolescent health. She was shocked to discover that suicide had replaced childbirth as the leading cause of death for girls ages 15 to 19. I had a chance to sit down and speak with her yesterday. This is our talk. For this segment, I'm here with Suzanne Petroni, who directs the Gender, Population, and Development Division of the International Center for Research on Women, which is working to advance the evidence base on sexual and reproductive health and rights, as well as the unique challenges facing adolescent girls worldwide. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you recently discovered some shocking statistics in the World Health Organization's report health of the world's adolescents, particularly facts on suicide in girls. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. So last year, WHO came out with this report, and it presented data on the causes of death as well as morbidity among adolescents worldwide. And it took a little bit of reading and a little bit of digging to figure this out, but when I did, I was fairly shocked. For years, those of us who work in the reproductive health community have talked about the importance of addressing adolescence and the fact that maternal mortality is the leading cause of death among girls age 15 to 19. And what these data showed was that actually maternal causes have been overtaken by suicide as the leading cause of death among 15 to 19-year-old girls worldwide. It varies regionally. South and East Asia are by far the driver of the global averages. Girls in South Asia and Southeast Asia are dying by suicide at rates up to 5 times higher than in other regions. So that's what we found. What we don't know is really why this is happening. The data are there, but the evidence as to the causes and importantly as to what we can do about them are not quite as strong. So we're hoping to do more research to really understand both the drivers and the preventers of suicide.
Even though the evidence isn't there, for sure, when I have to give credit, when I first saw this information, I was reading an article from The Guardian, and either the direction of the author or, you know, also your statements led me to understand that really you're looking into how inequality and gender norms impacts this suicide. So can you talk about that, even though I know you want to do more research?
Sure. I do work for a research institute, so that's always on our agenda. Certainly there's mounting evidence that really suggests that there is a connection between gender-based discrimination and suicide. Particularly that evidence comes from industrialized countries. We don't have as much in low and middle income countries, which is where we really do need to extend the evidence base. But what we hypothesize is that rigid social norms, and particularly norms around gender roles, are driving suicide and depression and poor mental health among both girls and boys. So we know from WHO that a lot of the causes or the drivers of suicide and depression are trauma and abuse and relationship conflict and social isolation, marginalization economically or socially. A lot of these drivers are also things that girls worldwide live with each and every day. And particularly for adolescent girls, some of these drivers are more intense. So those are the factors that we are hypothesizing are partly, at least, behind the increased rates of suicide.
Okay. And when you want to do more research, it just seems like it takes a tremendous capacity to be able to really explore this, especially in the developing world. What do the details tell you about young girls or girls in the industrialized countries where you have more data?
Well, again, it's discrimination and abuse and trauma. Sexual violence certainly comes into play. We do know a bit. I don't want to suggest that we don't know anything about what's happening in the low and middle income countries. Nor do I want to suggest that we don't know why adolescence in particular is an important phase of life. A lot of things happen during adolescence to the adolescent brain, to the adolescent's role in the community. Mm-hmm. And together, the gender norms and these changes during adolescence can lead to a situation where girls, and again, boys in some cases, may feel that suicide is their only option. So some of the things that intensify during adolescence are discrimination based on gender. So gender-based violence, for example, can increase. In many countries, child marriage is a significant risk factor. We know that 1 in 3 girls under the age of 18 is married each year in low and middle income countries. child marriage puts girls in a situation where very often they're taken out of school, they're taken away from their families and their peer networks, away from their friends, and they're forced into a situation where they don't have the means to control when and whether to have sex, when and whether to engage with people outside the home. Child brides often don't have the skills to negotiate with their husbands or their in-laws. So that is certainly something that we believe is a cause of depression and potentially could lead to suicidal behavior. We also know that sexual abuse and exploitation can increase during adolescence, and these are risk factors as well. Limitations on reproductive control. When girls start to become of reproductive age, and if they're in countries that limit their ability to access sexuality education or access family planning options, girls in countries like El Salvador, for example, may find themselves pregnant outside of marriage, and because there are such strict abortion laws in that country, they may feel that there are no alternatives but suicide. So these are some of the factors that we believe, based on the evidence that we do have, are contributing to this horrible outcome.
There is a difference you mentioned geographically. So when it comes to girls in Africa, suicide doesn't rank as high, but there are other problems. Can you give those details?
Yeah, so again, globally, self-harm or suicide is the leading cause of death for 15 to 19-year-old girls. I want to note, same number of boys in this age group actually die by suicide as girls. In terms of the rate, it's a little bit lower, but it's still a very significant issue for boys. And again, we believe that gender norms are likely a cause of this. Expectations about what makes a man may contribute to boys being depressed and considering suicide. Mm-hmm. So globally, that's what we know. In sub-Saharan Africa, suicide does not rank in the top five causes of death, and that's because girls age 15 to 19 are actually dying of HIV and AIDS at much higher rates than suicide, as well as maternal conditions. So globally, maternal mortality, thankfully, has decreased significantly in the past couple of decades. Mm-hmm. Africa is still far behind the global average. HIV and maternal mortality are very significant for adolescent girls in this region. So it's still something to consider, and certainly something that, again, because it's so preventable, we want to address. But we have a long way to go on behalf of the girls of Africa in terms of addressing HIV/AIDS and maternal mortality.
And actually, when I looked at the report, even though I was initially drawn to the figures on women, I was really shocked when I looked at the rate of death in Africa for adolescents compared to other parts of the world. There was an orange bar on the chart, and it was way up, like maybe two or three times higher than other places for deaths of all causes by adolescents. And can you talk about that? It just seemed like just a generation's being wiped out before they just become adults.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate fact in the world of global health that many countries in sub-Saharan Africa have a very long way to go in terms of addressing a range of public health issues. Let's take maternal conditions for one example. The global average in this age group of girls dying from maternal causes is about 10 girls per 100,000 in this age group. In Africa, it's about 34 per 100,000, so three to four times higher. HIV among adolescent girls is this population, 15 to 19-year-old girls, is the only population where HIV is increasing. In some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, girls are six to eight times more likely to be HIV positive than boys are these days. Mm-hmm. So this is a population that needs a significant amount of attention from the global health community.
Is there anything else that we haven't discussed that you want to mention in terms of what you've uncovered about this report and adolescent health internationally?
Yeah, I would just say that in the past couple of decades, we're finally beginning to recognize adolescence as a period of life, period, in the global health community. But really to understand more about the adolescent brain and how it develops during adolescent during this period of life, we're beginning to understand more that adolescents have particular health needs that have not necessarily been addressed in our public health world in the past. We've gone from focusing on child survival to maternal health and forgetting that critical period of life in between, to a point now where we are recognizing that, yes, actually, adolescents 10 to 19 years old do face their own health concerns, and we need to, as a global health community, pay better attention to them. All of these things can help a range of health outcomes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Suzanne. I've been speaking with Suzanne Petroni. She directs the Gender, Population, and Development Division of the International Center for Research on Women, which is working to advance the evidence base on sexual and reproductive health and rights, as well as the unique challenges facing adolescent girls worldwide. Thanks again, Suzanne.
I am an endangered species, but I sing no victim song. I am an artist, and I know where my voice belongs.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on WPFW Washington 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam, here with Michael Nasella on the boards and Michael Byfield, who will help take your calls to 202-588-0893.
Good morning.
Yes, 202-588-0893. So, what we're asking this morning is, what are your comments about this latest case of police brutality in McKinney, Texas, Eric Casebolt's apology through his attorney, and policing in the age of cell phone video and social media? You know, video seem to be the only way to really get justice, but what is the toll that they're taking on African Americans to have to relive these traumas? 202-588-0893 is the number to call. You can call 202-588-0893. You know, so I know, we've all seen the video. The latest video is that of a black person, this time a young black girl being brutalized by the police. And I have to say for myself that I did watch this video. I had no choice, actually, and it filled me with all kinds of emotions, including extreme concern for this 14-year-old girl, Dejeria Becton, and her friends who tried to come to her aid and were pushed back by adult whites who were not police officers. Apparently, the teens were also assaulted by some of these adult bystanders. But I have to say, I couldn't really bring myself to watch another recent video that apparently showed an 8 months pregnant woman, an African-American woman, being wrestled to the ground by police after a dispute with a white woman over a parking spot. So I couldn't watch that one. I successfully avoided it. And so our question is not just about the incident, but the impact that these videos are having on us. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. What are your comments about this latest case of police brutality in McKinney, Texas, Eric Casebolt's apology through his attorney, and policing in the age of cell phone video and social media? Videos are they seem to be the only way that we can get justice. If there's no video, there's no justice. But what is the toll that these videos are taking on us? 202-588-0893. And while we're waiting for your calls, we have comments from Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, formerly of the Los Angeles Police Department, speaking earlier this week on Democracy Now.
For me, as I watch Officer Casebolt, what I see is a bully. I see someone that was totally out of control, that was singularly focused on every African-American youth that he encountered. And then he paid particular attention to this young woman. Why? Because she failed to follow his orders. And what we see is what I like to refer to as contempt of cop. When you don't do what an officer says, there's a price to pay. And we've seen it over and over. Generally, we've seen that that price is death. Thank goodness no young person lost their life in this incident. But he punished her. He sat on top of her with the full weight of his body to make a point. And it was unnecessary. It was over the top, outrageous, and he needs to be fired. This is how this officer comports himself. I would venture to guess, if we were to look into his history, we'll see that there are probably other incidents where people have complained about excessive force, overzealousness on his part. And I would bet that that department does what a lot of police departments do, is minimize and mitigate that bad behavior. They circle the wagons, they shield the officers, and then that officer lives to offend again. And that's what happened here. This is not the first time that this officer has pulled his weapon out and used it as a bullying tool, as an intimidation tool to compel these children to come here, to sit down, to don't move, to shut up. A weapon is drawn in the immediate defense of your life or the life of another. And none of that was going on when he pulled his weapon out of its holster. It seems very criminal to me. Certainly, if a citizen was acting in this same manner, they would be charged with a litany of criminal violations. Assault.
Good morning. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
My name is William. I'm calling from Alexandria, Virginia.
Morning, William.
Morning.
Your comment?
My comment is that this is continuously happening. We have absolutely nothing being done by our state and federal government. Everything we see in these videos, from the young lady being attacked to someone being murdered, that is a violation of our civil rights, constitutionally protected rights, and we are not getting any relief from the people we vote for. That's where it starts. Other than that, we might as well just arm ourselves and end up, you know, at the OK Corral every weekend. I mean, this is inhumane.
Thank you for your comments. Next caller. Your name and where you're calling from.
Jay-Z from D.C. I just want to say that I think that in order to stop this, black people and other people have to start to become more proactive, instead of just be totally reactive. We know that these systems, these institutions, were created by white males to control non-white people, particularly black males. So we know this, and we shouldn't be surprised when these systems act out to maintain their control. So some of the things we should be doing proactively is, like, we should create a list of all police officers who have records of police complaints against them, and start processes to get them fired or to remove them from certain positions that interact with the public. We don't have to sit here and wait for the next tragedy to occur and then try to plead with the system to change. The system will exist as long as we sit back and let them do what they want to do, because that's what the system is designed to do. The system won't change until we change. And we haven't decided that we want to change yet enough to actually make a difference in our life. So that's why I just want to say that until we want to change and take power and not ask somebody else to change their nature, then we will continue to be subjected to their nature.
Thank you for your comment. Again, the number to call to comment on the latest case of police brutality in McKinney, Texas, is 202-588-0893. 202-588-0893. Next caller.
Good morning.
Good morning. And your name and where you're calling from?
I'm calling from Arlington, Texas.
Good morning.
What happened to the 14-year-old girl in McKinley, Texas, is simply racism, and the police officers are carrying the racism of the society. But racism is implemented by the police here and by dictators installed and supported and financed by America in Congo, in Rwanda, in Ethiopia, in Eritrea. And society, the racist society might say, I'm not black, it's not going to happen to me, why should I care? But racism in the final analysis is fascism. And about fascism, there is something said in Germany. They came and took the Gypsy, I kept quiet. They came and took the Jew, I kept quiet. And finally, they came after me. It will come. Your own racism will come after you through the extreme right wing of America, like Senator Jim Inhofe and the Tea Party. People, wake up and fight early while it's happening to the black people. Later on, you will regret, and they will come and take you too. Thank you.
Thank you, Tessa, for that very, very beautiful analogy. Next caller, please.
Yes, I want to agree with the second caller. We should have a list.
Your name and where you're calling from, please?
Virginia.
Hi.
If the Justice Department was doing its job, it would have a list. And this police officer will leave McKinney, Texas, go underground, and come right back up in another police department. And they will take him in. And that is what is happening. They're being recycled. And there's nothing to stop it. And so I agree with the second caller. We should have a national list, and it should be posted in every black church. You should contact your police department and find out, are any of these people on our police department here in the city where we have to live? It can be stopped. The recycling can be stopped. And there's nothing the FOP can do to stop that.
Thank you. That comment is, we get a lot of insightful comment, your suggestion, almost similar to the Predator database. The next caller, please.
Hello.
Good morning. Your name and where you're calling from?
Hey, I'm Sam. I'm calling from Virginia. Maryfield, Virginia. It's next Tyson's Corner. This is what I would like you guys to do in the media. If you could go ahead and analyze the situation and basically emphasize on a specific point, it would help. This is what I want to really mention, and I hope everybody understands this. What the officer did by putting his knee on the spinal cord of that lady and another knee at the back of her neck is exactly what killed Mr. Gray. Nobody has seen that as something that must be changed within the police. When you put your knee on the neck of someone, especially a young girl like that, and this guy is a grown-up and much bigger, you are going to create injury of the spinal cord. Gray's voice cord was crushed, spinal cord broken during the time they were arresting because of that very act. Why can't we focus and say it must be against the policy of the police to put a knee on the neck, a back of the neck, and also a knee on the spinal cord? Why can't we emphasize on that? Because to be honest with you, that is like trying to, you know, injure the person rather than trying to restrain the person. Especially as young, as small as she is, these acts must be outlawed. Do you get my point?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much for that very insightful comment. Caller, your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Jeffrey Alexander. I'm calling from Washington, D.C.
Your comment, sir?
Yes, my comment is there's one way that we can get rid of all of this madness is if the people in the community were the police in the community, if they went to the police force and got on the force, because they know the people in the community. So therefore, if, you know, you have police coming from all over the country going to police other communities, and if we had the people that live in the community as police in their community, I don't think that we would have all these problems.
Are you saying provide our a local police force outside of the regular police force?
That's correct, because the regular police force, the majority of them don't even live in the cities that they're policing.
Recently, we've heard a lot of ideas. There are communities with community policing forces. However, with our current over-policing, I don't know how a really organized community would probably have to run something like that.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for your call and your comments, sir. Okay, that will do it for today's On the Ground show. I want to thank Mike Nasella, Esther Averim, and all our guests for calling in. Again, this is WPFW 89.3.
If anything, it confirms this idea that he actually should not have been an officer at all. That if he had emotional trauma that he needed to work through, that he should never have been in a position where he could have taken someone's life, which is the position he was in when he drew his gun. So if anything, I'm recommitted to this notion that we need to figure out the standards for what policing is and how to deal with their emotional trauma. That officer bypassed many white young people who were there and put his hands on many black young people. And as the person who took the video said, is that he said, I felt invisible, which allowed him to continue filming, and the officer did nothing to him, but the officer put his knees in the back of a young black girl in a bikini who posed no threat, and he took his gun out to young men of color because he knew that he could and he knew that he had the power to do. It's definitely racially coded. We can't continue to believe that racism only exists at the extreme, was with the N-word and lynching. That was an act of racism there too. He escalated the situation because he had the power to do it, and he wanted to control not only the situation but also their bodies that posed no threat to him.
Goes.